1969, the fulfillment of a dream.
We copy you down, Eagle.
Listen, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
1969, a year of promise and hope.
I have decided to order the immediate redeployment from Vietnam of a division equivalent of approximately 25,000 men.
1969, a year of descent.
Oh, we are great.
Sing it so they can hear it.
Hear me again.
Are you listening, Nixon?
Oh, we are great.
1969, for some, a year of frustration.
And so I ask you tonight, the people of Massachusetts, to think this through with me. In facing this decision, I seek your advice and opinion. In making it, I seek your prayers.
1969, the end of a decade, the beginning of a new age of man.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
The Audio Network of United Press International presents 1969 in review. A review in sound of the significant news events of 1969, the year of man's landing on the moon.
I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal before this decade is out of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the earth.
And so the goal was set on May 25th, 1961, by the 35th President of the United States, John F. Kennedy. Finally, on July 16th, 1969, the long journey which began with Alan Shepard and the Mercury program was nearing its end. For the 21st time, an American space shot was putting men into space. And for the 21st time, the world held its breath.
6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour.
4 days later, July 20th, 1969, 164 days before the end of the decade, Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and Michael Collins had arrived. While Collins orbited the moon in the command ship, Armstrong and Aldrin descended to the surface of the moon.
Okay, engine stop. APA at a descent. Mode control, both auto descent, engine command override off. Engine arm off. 113 is in.
We copy you down, Eagle.
Listen, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
Now the two men were on the moon. 6 hours and 39 minutes later, one of them, Neil Armstrong, left the lunar module, climbed down the ladder, paused briefly at the bottom, and then...
I'm going to step off the limb now. It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. Yes, the surface is fine and powdery. I can pick it up loosely with my toe. It does adhere in fine layers, powdered charcoal to the sole and insides of my boot. I only go in a fraction of an inch, maybe an eighth of an inch, but I can see the footprints of my boots and the treads in the fine sandy particles.
Incredible as the July moon landing was, equally fantastic was the pinpoint moon landing of Apollo 12 in November. At the controls of Intrepid, the lunar excursion module, astronauts Pete Conrad and Alan Bean.
Hey, there it is. There it is. Finally got right down the middle of the road.
Outstanding. 42 degrees, Pete.
Hey, it's rising right from the center of the crater.
Look out there.
I can't believe it.
Amazing.
Fantastic.
31, 32, 30 feet. Coming down at 2 feet. You got plenty of gas. Plenty of gas, dude. Stay in there.
30 seconds.
18 feet. Coming down at 2. He's got it made. Come on in there. 24 feet. Contact light.
Roger. Copy contact.
Okay. It's turn off.
Okay.
I'll cycle these valves. You got your descending command override off.
Yep.
Okay, does. I'll cycle the main shutoff valve.
Okay.
Bus seat closed. You get both legs for the
day. The legs are closed.
Landing P. Outstanding, man. After I'm on, beautiful.
And beautiful it was. The spot they aimed for, 229,100 miles away, was hit on target. But we didn't know how close it was until astronaut Conrad became the third American to walk on the moon.
Man, that may have been a small one for Neil, but that's a long one for me. I'm going to step off the pad, Mark. Hey, that's neat. Now, I can walk pretty well, but I got to take it easy and watch what I'm doing. Oh, you'll never believe it. That's what I see sitting on the side of the crater.
The old surveyor, huh?
The old surveyor, yes, sir. Does that look neat? It can't be any further than 600 feet from here. How about that?
While the first steps on the moon were glorious, to many Americans they underscored the paradox and the discrepancy between man's achievements in science and technology and his failure to live in peace on Earth.
The Southern Christian Leadership Conference is not protesting America's ability to explore outer space, but we are protesting the injustice and inequity of the United States Congress in its appropriation to space exploration in comparison to its appropriation to keep men alive here on the face of this earth.
The number one complaint of many Americans in 1969 was the war in Vietnam. So they got together. They got together in a haphazard, slipshod way, but their numbers grew, 10,000, 50, 100,000, and twice more. They got together to demonstrate against the war. They called their get-together a moratorium.
The mass march on Washington to protest the Vietnam War is peaceful. About 3,000 mobilization marshals are keeping the demonstrators within the bounds of the march permitted by officials. The cry of peace now goes up in several places along the route of march almost continuously. Hands are held high with the anti-war peace sign. Flags, American, UN, peace, a pale blue with a dove in the center, and Viet Cong are waved all along the route of march. But just a few blocks from here, in the basement of the U.S. Capitol, a contingent of Marines waits in full battle gear ready if needed. A mile and a half route from the Capitol to the rally point at the Washington Monument remains a sea of humanity. Dennis Kahane, Washington.
The story of dissent against the war coming up next on United Press International's 1969 in Review. There were mostly young persons, and they marched. They called their march a march against death. It was part of the second moratorium day, November the 15th, 1969. In Washington, D.C., they marched, they chatted, they sang. It sounded like this. Crowds estimated at 250 to 500,000 persons took part in the demonstration in the nation's capital. A month earlier, across the country, thousands more showed their opposition to the war with parades and peace rallies. Leaders of the moratorium said they hoped by demonstrating they could get the administration to alter its Vietnam War policy. The president was asked if the demonstrators would accomplish that goal.
I have often said that there's really very little that we in Washington can do with regard to running the university and college campuses of this country. We have enough problems running the nation, the national problems. Now, I understand that there has been and continues to be opposition to the war in Vietnam on the campuses and also in the nation. As far as this kind of activity is concerned, we expect it. However, under no circumstances will I be affected, whatever, by it.
It was comedian Dick Gregory who answered the president. He did it bluntly and outspokenly.
Last month, the president of the United States said nothing you young kids would do would have any effect on him. Well, I suggest to the President of the United States, if he want to know how much effect you youngsters can have on the President, he should make one long-distance phone call to the LBJ Ranch and ask that boy how much effect you can have.
1969 in Review continues right after this message. Vice President Spiro Agnew called the demonstrators an effete corps of impudent snobs who characterized themselves as intellectuals. Many of the so-called silent majority agreed with him.
Right now, we can't back out because we never lost a war or anything in our lives, Americans. And the people down here today, I feel they're demonstrating because they don't want to go in the service and defend their country. I'm down here because I have defended my country, and I want the purpose to be that we're down here to fight for our country and risk anything. If we back out of Vietnam right now, there's going to be a war in Bangkok maybe 6-7 months later.
There are also people who are collaborating with the enemies of freedom.
I think it's disgraceful, and I'm back to President. The reason is that I think that they are on the way to making peace. Certainly not the beatniks that are on the streets, and he's right when he said it's anarchy when they allow this sort of thing to happen.
I believe very strong that as long as we are there, we have to fight and win, that's all.
I think we should get out of there, but not the way they're doing it. I don't think this moratorium should even come off.
I think they are sincere, but I think they are misled. I think that any criticism, and this is a criticism, should be also supported with a constructive suggestion as to how we can do it better than the president of our country can.
It was to the silent majority that President Nixon appealed for support when he gave a major speech on the administration's Vietnam policy on November the 3rd.
The effect of all the public, private, and secret negotiations which have been undertaken since the bombing halt a year ago and since this administration came into office on January 20th, can be summed up in one sentence. No progress whatever has been made except agreement on the shape of the bargaining table. So tonight, to you, the great silent majority of my fellow Americans, I ask for your support. The more support I can have from the American people, the sooner that pledge can be redeemed. For the more divided we are at home, the less likely the enemy is to negotiate at Paris.
On the surface, the war in 1969 did not change. Expanded peace talks began in January, but got nowhere. Both sides offered peace plans. Each side rejected the other. Then in June, the president met on Midway Island in the Pacific with South Vietnamese President Chu. Out of the meeting came this announcement.
President Chu informed me that the progress of South Vietnamese forces had been so successful that he could now recommend that the United States begin to replace U.S. combat forces with Vietnamese forces. This same assessment was made by General Abrams when he reported to me last night and this morning. As a consequence of the recommendation by the President and the assessment of our own commander in the fields, I have decided to order the immediate redeployment from Vietnam of a division equivalent of approximately 25,000 men.
Throughout the year, the war continued, and a few incidents did not make it an easier war for some to accept. First, there was a partial mutiny by a number of men in one company. They refused to go back into a battle they had been fighting for 5 days. However, the mutiny was short-lived, and the men soon were fighting again. 8 Green Berets were charged with murdering a Vietnamese they suspected of being an enemy agent. Public sentiment became great, and Secretary of the Army Stanley Rezor eventually ordered the case dismissed.
I've been advised today that the Central Intelligence Agency, though not directly involved in the alleged incident, has determined that in the interest of national security, it will not make available any of its personnel as witnesses in connection with the pending trials in Vietnam of Army personnel assigned to the 5th Special Forces Group. It is my judgment that under these circumstances, the defendants cannot receive a fair trial. Accordingly, I have directed today that all charges be dismissed immediately.
Everyone knows about the horrors of war. But it's always the other guy who commits the atrocious act, the bad guy. So when a story about a massacre of Vietnamese villagers by American soldiers was made public, many Americans were appalled. An army platoon is said to have raided a Vietnamese village and then, allegedly following the orders of Lieutenant William Kelly, shot down every villager, men, women, and children. The Pentagon is investigating the matter, and Lieutenant Kelly, charged with murder, will go on trial in early 1970. The death of Ho Chi Minh, the ineffectiveness of the peace talks, and the withdrawal of American troops seemed to have little effect on the war. For President Nixon, it was still his most pressing problem, as it was for the man he succeeded.
Now it's time to leave. I hope it may be said 100 years from now that by working together, we help to make our country more just. I believe that at least it will be said that we tried.
I, Richard Billhouse Nixon, do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. So help me God.
A new administration takes over in 1969. United Press International looks at the first year of a new president, coming up next on 1969 in Review. On January 20th, 1969, Richard Milhouse Nixon was sworn in as the 37th President of the United States. As those before him had done, the new president promised to listen to all the people.
When we listen to the better angels of our nature, we find that they celebrate the simple things, the basic things, such as goodness, decency, love, kindness. Greatness comes in simple trappings. The simple things are the ones most needed today if we are to surmount what divides us and cement what unites us. To lower our voices would be a simple thing. In these difficult years, America has suffered from a fever of words, from inflated rhetoric that promises more than it can deliver, from angry rhetoric that fans discontents into hatreds, from bombastic rhetoric that postures instead of persuading. We cannot learn from one another until we stop shouting at one another, until we speak quietly enough so that our words can be heard as well as our voices.
The ceremonies that followed the inauguration were a mixture of marching bands, patriotic songs, and a sprinkling of demonstrations.
Soldiers. As the soldiers passed, the demonstrators yell, "Ho, ho, Ho Chi Minh." North Vietnam is going to win. On Pennsylvania Avenue.
And so began the year for Richard Nixon. 1969 in Review continues after this message. The year 1969 was certainly not a dull one for the new president. Nixon faced his first real congressional test squarely. He was for, and wanted Congress to approve, an anti-ballistic missile defense system.
The new program that I have recommended this morning to the leaders and that I announced today is one that perhaps best can be described as a safeguard program. It is a safeguard against any attack by the Chinese Communists that we can foresee over the next 10 years. It is a safeguard of our deterrent system, which is increasingly vulnerable due to the advances that have been made by the Soviet Union since the year 1967, when the Sentinel program was first laid out. It is a safeguard also against any irrational or accidental attack that might occur of less than massive magnitude, which might be launched from the Soviet Union.
The debate grew steadily. Senator Alan Cranston.
I'm deeply disappointed. I hoped and almost believed that the president would make a wiser decision. I think that history may well record that after 53 days of almost errorless performance as president, President Nixon made a tragic mistake on the 53rd day of his administration. I think it's particularly sad and unfortunate that he has done this exactly one day after the adoption by the Senate of ratification of the Nuclear Anti-Proliferation Treaty has raised great hopes of curtailing the arms race. I think this move, to some degree, cancels that and moves us in a different direction. I think it moves us toward a heightening of the arms race, toward increasing difficulties in negotiating with the Soviet Union. It will divide the United States in many ways. It will lead to a bitter battle in the Senate, the outcome of which cannot be foretold. I think it will heighten tensions in the world.
It was a toss-up all the way, but Nixon did win. Senator Strom Thurmond approved of the vote.
I'm very proud that the Senate approved the ABM and turned down the amendments that wish to delay it or kill it. In my judgment, the ABM is purely a defensive weapon. It's necessary that we go forward. The Soviets are at least 5 years ahead of us. If we have the ABM and the enemy doesn't send any missiles over to destroy our country, then well and good. If it does send missiles over to destroy our country, we'll be mighty glad we have it.
Traveling must have been in the stars for the president in 1969. He made three major trips out of the country. First to Western Europe in February, when he visited Germany, Italy, France, Denmark, and England. In June, he flew to Midway Island, where he made the troop withdrawal announcement. Then an around-the-world trip in July, following the Apollo 11 splashdown, took him to the Philippines, Indonesia, Thailand, South Vietnam, India, and Pakistan. But the highlight of the jaunt was his visit to the communist country of Romania. The scene, Bucharest.
This is an historic occasion. While this is not my first visit to your country, it is the first visit of a president of the United States to Romania. The first state visit by an American president to a socialist country or to this region of the continent of Europe. Mr. President, this significant moment in the history of relations between our two countries coincides with a great moment in the history of the human race. We have established a foothold in outer space. But there are goals that we have not reached here on Earth. We are still building a just peace in the world.
The Supreme Court made its share of headlines in 1969, but their decisions didn't account for as many of the headlines as the individual justices did. First, Justice Abe Fortas resigned from the High Court after he was accused of unethical financial dealings with a foundation set up by financier Lewis Wolfson. Chief Justice Earl Warren retired in June, and U.S. Court of Appeals Judge Warren Burger was Nixon's nominee to take over the vacated post. His nomination was quickly accepted by the Senate. With one vacancy to fill, Nixon proposed the name of Federal District Judge Clement Haynesworth. This set off a debate in Congress. The opposition to Haynesworth was taken up by many Senate liberals. One who was concerned was Senator Philip Hart of Michigan.
You bet I'm concerned at the nomination of the Supreme Court of a man who has been reversed, I guess it's fair to say consistently, on appeals from his civil rights and labor management decisions. We can misread items of impropriety and their appearances. You can't misread a philosophy that would be, in my book, unacceptable. And if there is, in fact, a constant reversal of the nominee's opinions when they got to the Supreme Court in labor management cases and civil rights cases, then in my book, the court was right and he was wrong.
Speaking for the South Carolina judge was Republican Senator Marlo Cook of Kentucky.
I feel that he is being subjected to a character assassination that is unjustified. I feel that he is a man of honesty and a man of integrity.
Finally, after 3 months, the Senate vote was taken. The result, 45 said yes, 55 said no. For Nixon, his first taste of defeat as chief executive. Senator Ted Kennedy may have seen his chances for becoming president deflated because of a bizarre and almost unbelievable car accident in which he was involved. That story next on 1969 in Review. Hey, Jack. Senator Ted Kennedy's car accident, which took the life of Mary Jo Kopechne, was a confusing tale. It all started as a party. a party performer aide to the senator's late brother, Robert. It was shortly after 11 o'clock that night when
When I left the party around 11:15 p.m., I was accompanied by one of these girls, Miss Mary Jo Kopechne. A little over 1 mile away, the car that I was driving, on an unlit road to an awful narrow bridge, which had no guardrails and was built on a left angle to the road. The car overturned in a deep pond and immediately filled with water. I remember thinking as the cold water rushed in around my head that I was for certain drowning. Then water entered my lungs and I actually felt the sensation of drowning. But somehow I struggled to the surface alive. I made immediate and repeated efforts to save Mary Jo by diving into the strong and murky current, but succeeded only in increasing my state of utter exhaustion and alarm. My conduct and conversations during the next several hours, to the extent that I can remember them, make no sense to me at all. I regard as indefensible the fact that I did not report the accident to the police immediately.
The United Press International 1969 in review will continue right after this message. For Ted Kennedy, July 1969 was a time for reflection. What effect did the accident have on his role as a representative of the people of Massachusetts? He decided to ask them personally on a nationally televised program.
If at any time the citizens of Massachusetts should lack confidence in their senator's character or his ability, with or without justification, he could not, in my opinion, adequately perform his duties and should not continue in office. The opportunity to work with you and serve Massachusetts has made my life worthwhile. And so I ask you tonight, the people of Massachusetts, to think this through with me. In facing this decision, I seek your advice and opinion. In making it, I seek your prayers. For this is a decision that I will have finally to make on my own.
The answer they gave was clear. Stay in office, and he did. But the unanswered questions about the accident prompted the county district attorney to call for an inquest which may or may not provide the answers. Actually, the year started out rather well for the young senator. He won the majority whip post in the Senate by defeating Senator Russell Long. His positions on the ABM, Vietnam, and the draft followed moderate liberal lines and were accepted by many. His name came up whenever someone talked about a Democratic presidential candidate for 1972. But for him, 1969 may have changed all that. The memory of Bobby Kennedy was regenerated when the trial of his accused assassin came to an end. The verdict, guilty. The sentence, death in the California gas chamber. Another assassin shocked the country by pleading guilty to the murder of Martin Luther King. For his penalty, James Earl Ray received 99 years in prison. His guilty plea and conviction aroused a public who thought he may have been part of a conspiracy. However, the Justice Department insisted no evidence of a conspiracy existed. There are those who thought of all the leaders in the world, one was seemingly invincible. But 1969 proved them wrong.
At the age of 78, President Charles de Gaulle showed France and the world he still has plenty of fight left. Running as underdog in advance polls for a nationwide referendum Sunday on which he has gambled his political future, de Gaulle came out fighting in an 8-minute television speech to the nation. Using all the mastery of the French language and the eloquent gestures for which he's famous, de Gaulle again warned the nation in no uncertain terms he will quit if the vote on a constitutional reform goes against him. He sounded firm and indomitable.
Ma tâche actuelle de chef de l'État deviendra évidemment impossible et je cesserai aussitôt d'exercer mes fonctions.
It was a virtuoso performance in the old style, and with only 2 points to catch up, observers believed it could well tip the scales in favor of another 3 years of personal de Gaulle rule for France. Michael Denigan, Paris.
The vote came in and de Gaulle went out. His place was taken by Georges Pompidou, and despite de Gaulle's predictions, France remained calm after his defeat. A little girl, a warm voice. She captured the movie audiences of the 30s and the 40s, the television fans of the 50s and 60s. The Palace Theater in New York City became Judy's castle. She became a legend in show business that few can challenge. It started with a hop and a skip down a yellow brick road. Judy Garland was dead in 1969. What made her what she was? Ray Bolger, the scarecrow who searched for a brain in the Wizard of Oz, tried to say.
It's impossible to believe. You know, I mean, it's just a little girl gone from your life, if you knew her. Sometimes cynical about the world that she lived in, but always looking for the joy. Always joyous. Always. She was the happiest person when she was happy. And like Lisa said, she was the saddest person when she was sad. There's only one person like Judy. Judy was unique. Judy was a star. There are only one of each kind. It says in the theatrical contract in Vaudeville many years ago, where they were very discriminating, that you are unique, extraordinary, and cannot be duplicated. That was a star, and that was Judy. Who is going to be another Judy? Who is going to think like she thinks? Who is going to have that tear in the voice like she had? No one.
The most widely spread rumor in 1969 was that one of the Beatles was dead. His fans pointed to circumstantial evidence, symbolic and otherwise, on record jackets and in the songs the Beatles sang. They said it all proved one thing. Beatle Paul McCartney was dead.
Anyway, all of the things that have been, you know, that have made these rumors, to my mind, have very ordinary logical explanations. To the people's minds who prefer to think of them as rumors, then I'm not going to interfere. I'm not going to spoil their fantasy. You know, you can think of it like that if you like. However, if the end result, if the conclusion you reach is that I'm dead, then you're wrong.
Because you're obviously very much alive.
Because I'm alive and living in Scotland.
But death did come to some in 1969. It came to actors Boris Karloff and Robert Taylor, journalist Ralph McGill, Westbrook Pegler, and Drew Pearson. Leaders of many and few, such as Israeli Premier Levi Eshkol, Alan Dulles, Moise Shambe, Everett Dirksen, Tom Mboya, John L. Lewis, and Joseph Kennedy Sr. And death came to a great American, Dwight David Eisenhower. That story next on UPI's 1969 in Review.
Some men are considered great because they lead great armies or they lead powerful nations. For 8 years now, Dwight Eisenhower has neither commanded an army nor led a nation. And yet, he remained through his final days the world's most admired and respected man, truly the first citizen of the world.
Dwight David Eisenhower, the Grand General of World War II. The popular war hero who became president in 1952 is gone. His death was not sudden. It came after he had suffered his seventh heart attack in 14 years. A state funeral was held in Washington. Leaders from around the world gathered to pay their respects to the man they called Ike. The former president's body lay in state for 3 days. Then it was taken to its final resting place, Ike's hometown of Abilene, Kansas.
I know Mrs. Eisenhower would permit me to share with you the last word she spoke to him on the day he died. He said, "I've always loved my wife. I've always loved my children. I've always loved my grandchildren. And I have always loved my country." That was Dwight Eisenhower.
Listening to the UPI Audio Year-End Show, 1969 in review. We'll be back right after this message. In January 1968, Dr. Philip Bleiberg became the world's second heart transplant patient. For 19 months and 15 days, he lived with the heart of another man. But that heart, too, quit. Dr. Christian Barnard, Bleiberg's doctor, tells why he died.
Unfortunately, today, it's not possible yet to completely prevent rejection. It's only possible to slow it down. In the case of Dr. Bleiberg, we have slowed it down for about 563 days. But eventually the chronic rejection had damaged the heart to such an extent that it failed. And although we don't have the complete results of the post-mortem yet, I think this will be the eventual finding that the heart has been severely damaged by the rejection. I'd like to point out to you that I don't think we should be discouraged and throw up our arms and say that this is now the end, because we have now operated on 5 patients. And the total days of survival so far of these 5 patients have been 1,101 days. I think that gives you an average survival of 200 days.
A man lives for 563 days with the heart of another human. But to live with a heart made of plastic, few would believe it. In 1969, it was so. Dr. Denton Cooley of Houston, Texas, transplanted an artificial, an unreal heart, and the patient, Haskell Karp, lived for 65 hours. 200 saints of the Roman Catholic Church were chopped off the liturgical calendar. The Vatican said in some cases there were doubts of the existence of many of those removed, and others had major flaws in the authenticity of their saintly endeavors. Included in the list, St. Valentine, St. Christopher, and, yes, Virginia, St. Nicholas. It was Christmas Eve, 1968, when the 82 surviving crew members of the U.S. spy ship Pueblo were reunited with their families, after almost a year as prisoners of the North Korean government. 5 months later, a Navy court of inquiry recommended that Commander Lloyd Booker and Intelligence Officer Lieutenant Stephen Harris be court-martialed, but Secretary of the Navy John Chafee went against the recommendation.
My review was, of course, limited to the evidence and to the findings, opinions, and recommendations of this court of inquiry and the recommendations of the subsequent reviewing authorities. As a result of my review, I have decided that no disciplinary action will be taken against any of the personnel involved in the Pueblo incident.
Troubles continued in Korea for the United States in 1969 when North Korea shot down a U.S. electronic scout plane in April, killing 31 crewmen. And in August, 3 men aboard a U.S. Army helicopter were captured after their craft was shot down by the North Koreans. The men were released in December. In the Middle East, Arab-Israeli battling continued. Pressures from other nations to limit the conflict were somewhat successful, but the effort for lasting peace was a failure. In Northern Ireland, Protestants and Roman Catholics clashed throughout the year. The minority Catholics say they've been denied civil rights by the ruling Protestants. In April and in August, the fighting came close to civil war proportions. It got so bad that the British flew in troops to quell the fighting. In one place, barbed wire barricades were used to separate the two groups. UPI reporter Edwin Smith was in Belfast, Northern Ireland, during some of the most fierce exchanges.
I'm up a side street, Conrad Street, running off Falls Road. There's been some sniping here just before I arrived. The people tell me that 2, possibly 4 men have been shot down in the street by snipers. They insist that it's something heavier than a .22 rifle, something about the size of what they say would be a police rifle. The men insist they've spotted somebody over the other side of the wall of the monastery with a gun. The man here has a shotgun and 6 rounds of ammunition. They're working their way forward, trying to spot the supposed sniper. Another shot behind us, and here's a man with a .22 rifle. Obviously a few rounds of ammunition. He's heading back towards the street from which that shot came. Now we're getting shooting. Rapid semi-automatic fire by the sound of it. Fairly light. Might be a very fast action .22 rifle. No indication what he's shooting at or indeed where he is. over behind the wall and a screen of trees behind the monastery. And behind that is the burning chemical works, which has been flaming for 2 or 3 hours now.
Russia and China pressed on with their 10-year-old border dispute. They fought each other to a point just short of war.
The Chinese and Russians fought a pitched battle on the ice of the Ussuri River. Thousands of men were involved, and it lasted for 7 hours. Now, through a tape recorded by Soviet radio, we can hear Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Konstantinov on the Soviet bank of the river with his officers planning the counterattack which finally drove the Chinese off to Mansky Island. According to our information, there's a regiment over there. Mortar fire there. It's here. We're told it's .108. The battle goes on. Machine guns and rifles can be heard. The explosions of mines and shells in the ice. Just as has happened before in our lives. Edward Shields in Moscow.
During the confrontations, there were casualties on both sides. A meeting of leaders from both the Soviet Union and China was held, during which time a ceasefire was agreed to. At year's end, the talks were on the verge of collapsing. For the Russians, the year wasn't one of their best. Besides the border clashes with the Chinese, the Americans winning the race to the moon, there were the Czechs who observed the first anniversary of the Russian occupation of their country in an extraordinary way. That story coming up on UPI's 1969 in Review. For Czechoslovakia, 1969 was a year for remembering. On August 21st, they remembered how the Russians came into their country in 1968 with tanks and soldiers. They remembered with contempt, with defiance. UPI correspondent John Amstutz reports from Prague. This is how it all began.
It started with whistling at the head of the square. Precisely at 12. And spread down through the square as if on signal. A group of young people waving wet red flowers over their heads and shouting, "Go on home, go on home, go on home." Marched down the middle of the tram tracks, right through the heart of the square. Traffic gone to a complete standstill. The people are booing of their own free will, without a bit of police action being taken, away from the square. They're clapping, they're shouting. Every window in the houses around is full of people looking out, watching.
In Czechoslovakia, in Prague, in Wenceslas Square at high noon, a Times Square in a faraway land of communism, the sound of traffic horns, bells, whistles, and applause. This is Prague ringing in a new year of Soviet military occupation. This is the sound of defiance behind the Iron Curtain. This is 100,000 persons thumbing their nose at the Russians right in the Russians' faces.
Crossing across Wenceslas Square in an apparent show of force. There began the whistle, a siren.
And so that's how it was in Czechoslovakia one day in 1969. 1969 in Review will continue after this pause. ...1969 was a year of airplane hijacks, most of them to Cuba. Over 50 times, planes had been diverted to a destination other than the one they started out for. But the most unique, and certainly the most dramatic hijack, took place, appropriately enough, on Halloween, 22,000 feet above Fresno, California.
At approximately 1:45 after departing Los Angeles, about 15 minutes after we took off, cockpit door was opened by a key, and a young man entered holding a cut-down version of a military carbine pointed at one of the hostesses. He told us that he wanted to go to New York. We advised him we didn't have enough fuel to go to New York, and at the very beginning he was quite nervous and insisted that he knew that the range of the airplane was enough to go to New York, so we finally convinced him and calmed him down.
That was TWA pilot Donald Cook, captain of Flight 85. For 17 hours, he did not give the orders. After hopscotching across the country from California with stops in Denver, New York, and Bangor, Maine, the hijacker said he wanted to go to Europe. So to Europe he went. First, Shannon, Ireland. Then the final destination, Rome, where he was captured. The hijacker was a 19-year-old AWOL Marine who was born in Italy. He wanted to go back home. He's now in a Rome jail awaiting a decision on who will try him, Italy or the United States. Natural disasters took their toll in lives and damage. The worst floods in 32 years hit California. 92 died, and property damage was estimated at $56 million. Hurricane Camille demolished the Gulf Coast. It claimed over 300 lives and damaged $1.4 billion worth of property. The joke at first was, Spiro who? Well, in 1969, they knew.
It appears that by slaughtering a sacred cow, I triggered a holy war. I have no regrets. I do not intend to repudiate my beliefs, recant my words, or run and hide.
The Vice President of the United States, Spiro T. Agnew. He made many speeches in 1969, one in Des Moines, Iowa, attacked television network news.
Networks, he stated, which are few in number, have a virtual monopoly of a whole medium of communication. The newspapers of mass circulation have no monopoly on the medium of print. Now, a virtual monopoly of a whole medium of communication is not something that democratic people should blithely ignore. And we are not going to cut off our television sets and listen to the phonograph just because the airways belong to the networks. They don't. They belong to the people.
The networks quickly rushed to their own defense. Here is Julian Goodman, president of the NBC television network.
Vice President Agnew's attack on television news is an appeal to prejudice. More importantly, Mr. Agnew uses the influence of his high office to criticize the way a government-licensed news medium covers the activities of the government itself. Any fair-minded viewer knows that television networks are not devoted to putting across a single point of view, but that they present all significant views on issues of importance. It is regrettable that the Vice President of the United States would deny to television freedom of the press.
One weekend in August, a 20-acre cornfield in New York State was filled with a crush of humanity. It was called the Woodstock Music and Art Fair. For 3 days, 300,000 youngsters swayed to the beat of rock music. Some smoked pot openly, some tripped with hallucinogenic drugs. But contrary to predictions, under the most trying conditions, they existed together without one major incident of crime or violence.
Right now, we've had more people here at one time in 3 days, 4 days, than I think we've had in the history of the town of Bethel. The people, the kids are very nice, very polite, they're very well mannered. We haven't had a bit of trouble with them. They are a fine bunch of people. It's utter chaos.
That's exactly what it is. I never seen so many cars in my life and so many people. It's amazing. These kids are the greatest kids I ever met. They're all wonderful. I never seen anything like it. If a car runs out of gas, they just lean against it and push it ahead of them. That's all they do. I don't know what they call themselves. They all got different kind of costumes on, and some of them look weird and some of them look good. It doesn't make much difference, but they all behave themselves.
So it was in Woodstock, New York, Prague, Czechoslovakia, Chappaquiddick, Massachusetts, Washington, D.C., Vietnam, on the moon and outer space. So it was in 1969. You've been listening to 1969 in Review. This program was produced by Stan Sabick. Technical director was Frank Shortino, and I'm Ed Cairns. 1969 in Review is a production of the Audio Network of United Press International.